Chapter 13. London, 1947.
I would like to have had a sister instead of all those brothers.
Elsie Finch buttered another scone and lifted it to her lips, followed by her table napkin with which she appeared to be hiding the fact that she was chewing.
Oh, I don't know about that, said Eleanor. As girls, Cecily and I didn't always get on, and our arguments upset my mother terribly, especially after we came to England. She set down her cup in the saucer and looked around at other ladies taking tea at Fortnum and Mason, then back to the woman before her, though I have missed her since, well, since she died.
Horrible, losing your mother and sister on the same day.
And my grandmother. I was at work when it happened, and it was only when I walked down the street toward the house that I realized it was gone. The whole street had been destroyed.
They dropped those heavy bombs like they were eggs, didn't they? Mind you, I think the doodlebugs were the worst. You'd hear that buzzing, and when it stopped, you knew it was coming down, and you didn't know which way to run. That's what took my Abe. He was a good man, my late husband.
Elsie fluttered her ring-laden fingers over a plate of petite fours, before lifting one topped with pink icing.
You'd never know there was still rationing going on when you come in here. That's why I always treat myself, you know, after Raymond has given me a new hairdo.
Eleanor thought the hairdo was the same as last week's version.
He does a lovely job, doesn't he? Mind you, the girl who set my hair has a good eye, though she was rather insistent about what she thought would suit me.
Raymond trains them all, you know.
Elsie sipped her tea and stared at Eleanor.
So, what did you do in the war? You said you were coming home from work.
Teaching, said Eleanor.
I thought most of the London schools were closed, said Elsie.
It was a small private girls' school in Kensington.
What did you teach?
Languages, French, Italian, German, and some Latin, which the girls didn't care for at all. The school moved out of London when war was declared. Then we brought the senior pupils back into the old school in 1944. Not the best decision on the part of the headmistress, but fortunately we weren't bombed.
I would have liked a profession, but my father was old-fashioned, you know. The only work women were supposed to be good for was in the kitchen.
The war changed life for many women, Elsie.
Well, the old boy is Italian, and still alive, I might add. He rules the whole family, she grinned. But I'll have the last laugh on him and those brothers of mine.
The last laugh? Eleanor lifted a hand to brush back her hair. Though she had complimented the hairdresser, she wasn't sure about the Veronica Lake look styled by Pauline, who was assigned to her that day.
Dad is losing his marbles, said Elsie. Mind you, he can still give orders.
She leaned back and grinned.
Though my brothers don't know who's giving Dad the orders he gives out. More fool them. For assuming the only thing I'm good for is keeping an eye on the old boy and making sure the nurse changes his dirty knickers.
She paused, nodding toward Eleanor.
I'd pin that back if I were you. I can see you don't like that bit of hair flopping everywhere.
You're right, said Eleanor. She reached into her pocket, found a hair grip, and clipped back the long curl styled down one side of her face.
That's better. She smiled and poured more tea into both cups. Do your brothers listen to your father? I mean, they're grown men, aren't they, with children of their own?
You don't know what Italians are like, Eleanor. There's the boys, my brothers, and then there's their boys, and all of them are in the family business.
Any girls?
I've four nieces. I'm taking them under my wing, though, so they don't end up idle and brainless. She chuckled. That's five of us girls, and five is my lucky number.
What's the family business?
Elsie Finch shrugged.
Warehousing, storage, removals, that sort of thing.
Eleanor nodded.
I suppose there's quite a call for it, people having been bombed out and needing a place to put their things, furniture and whatever they could salvage, and then moving into a new house or flat when they've found one, if they're lucky enough to find one.
Yes, as I said, that sort of thing.
Elsie glanced at her gold watch, which Eleanor noticed was studded with diamonds around the dial.
Goodness, you're right to look at the time,
said Eleanor, checking her own plane watch. I've a few errands to run, and I mustn't be late to catch my train.
Where is it you live, my dear?
Asked Elsie, pushing back her chair. She came to her feet on unsteady legs. Tunbridge Wells, said Eleanor. I thought I told you. Elsie nodded.
Oh, yes, I remember now. My nephew Jimmy, John's youngest, he lives down in Kent, much farther down into the country, though. Place called, Somethinghurst.
There are a lot of Somethinghursts in Kent, said Eleanor, smiling. She had already settled the bill.
I know, his father didn't like it at all. My brother is too much like Francisco.
Francisco?
The old boy, that's his name. Our father, who art in his wheelchair. The patriarch, Jimmy's dad, is too much like him, if you ask me. In fact, my brothers are all the same. As I said, they think women should be in the kitchen. But I'll have the last laugh on those boys, you mark my words.
I won't ask how you intend to do that, Elsie, said Eleanor, smiling, as the women began to walk toward the exit. When I planned to have the last laugh on my sister, it usually meant putting spiders in her bed.
I wish I'd have thought of that, said Elsie.
She turned to Eleanor.
Lovely of you to treat me to tea. I didn't expect you to pay when I invited you to join me here. Very kind of you. I don't get out as much. Not since my husband died, so it's lovely to have a chat with another woman.
For me too, Elsie.
Are you sure I can't drop you anywhere? My driver's waiting just outside.
I've a spot of shopping to do, and I fancy a walk after that tea, said Eleanor.
But thank you. I hope we can do this again. Next week?
Asked Elsie. Eleanor pointed to the forelock of hair now pinned back.
As long as I don't get the Veronica Lake. I was hoping for more of a Rita Hayworth.
Elsie Finch laughed, gave a short wave and turned to walk toward the motor car double parked outside. The driver ready and waiting with the rear passenger door open. Eleanor felt a wave of sympathy for Elsie, a short, round woman who, she thought, ached for the elegance of those mannequins who could carry off Christian Dior's new look. It had been launched in an edition of Harper's Bazaar earlier in the year, with photos of a whippet-thin young woman wearing a black skirt with a lower calf-length hem complemented by a cream jacket, its nipped-in waist and soft, rounded shoulders in direct contrast to the masculine look of wartime. Elsie must have been one of the first women to wear the sought-after costume. Yet instead of stunning onlookers with her fashionable attire, she appeared more reminiscent of Queen Victoria in her later years. No wonder she has a chip on her shoulder, Eleanor whispered to herself as she stepped away from Fortnum and Mason and set off in the direction of Piccadilly Circus and the tube station. Eleanor caught a Bakerloo line train to Charing Cross, which put her in the right place for an easy walk along to Scotland Yard. Once again, Steve Warren was not at the yard, though she bumped into Detective Sergeants Bob Mills and Charlie Kettle as they were leaving.
We're off to Catford Dogs, Miss White,
Charlie Kettle grinned, then glanced at Bob Mills with an almost imperceptible wink before turning back to Eleanor.
Want to come with us? Observe what it's all about at the sharp end of our sort of police work?
Eleanor had taken note of the exchange and suspected there would be a benign attempt to shock her, what the detectives might consider a bit of fun.
There's an offer I can't refuse, Charlie, said Eleanor. Count me in.
She had never been to a dog racing stadium and wasn't sure she really wanted to see greyhounds running at speed, around a circuit, chasing a hare, even though it was fake. Or was it the question disturbed her?
The hare isn't real, you know. It's driven by electricity, said Bob, as if reading her mind.
Bob, I know that, said Eleanor. Let's get on our way then, shall we?
The drive to Catford in southeast London took longer than it might have, given the city traffic and the time of day. As soon as they were south of the river, horses and carts vied for a place on the road, along with trams, lorries and buses, and because flesh and blood horsepower still had right of way over other vehicular traffic, it was slow going. The journey gave Eleanor a chance to ask a few more questions and to get to know Warren's detective sergeants a little better, and she was aware they intended to use the time spent in the motor car to find out more about her.
So, you knew DCI Warren in the war, did you?
asked Charlie Kettle.
"What, you're in the same department? Something like that?"
"I'd better be careful," said Eleanor, as if she were teasing the men.
"What did he say?"
"Not a lot. We reckon it was all a bit hush-hush."
Eleanor shrugged. "It probably was. I can't say I know. Everyone had different jobs."
"Oh?"
said Bob. "But before the war I was a teacher, a French, German and Italian. Then when the evacuations began, the school moved out of London. I met Detective Chief Inspector Warren when I was called up, and, well, you know what it's like in the services. You meet all sorts, don't you?"
Giving the impression that they had crossed paths in the regular army without telling an outright lie was deliberate. She knew it was better for any cover story to run as close to the truth as possible, because the person asking questions might well be trained in the identification of lies. The phrase rolled around in her mind for a few seconds. The identification of lies.
"But didn't he say you could look after yourself? We assumed it was something to do with your job."
Charlie turned around from the front passenger seat of the Humber motor car to query Eleanor. Eleanor laughed. "All the women had special training, didn't they?" She left the thought hanging as if it were proven truth, then continued, "But I'd already taken it a step further, because being a teacher responsible for girls coming into womanhood during a time of war, well, you have to make sure they're the ones who can look after themselves. What with all those troops from overseas coming into the country, attacks on women escalated. It was hushed up, but we all knew it was happening, didn't we? And we know British soldiers weren't above suspicion in that regard either." Another pause as both men seemed to shift in their seats. "Anyway, the headmistress brought in a teacher of martial arts, and the girls learned a few things about self-defence. So I joined in with a couple of the other women teachers so we could practice with them after school. And I was glad I'd done it, because I worked late sometimes, and I hated walking along the street in the blackout. I was terrified a gang of drunk squaddies would come stumbling toward me, thinking I was one of those Piccadilly commandos. Not that I was in that particular area, but it's fair to say a woman alone wasn't safe."
Bob glanced in the rearview mirror and nodded.
"There's a description that went round fast, eh? Piccadilly commandos. The Messinas were running those girls. The Americans, especially, would roll out of Rainbow Corner in the other pubs and clubs. And there were the Messinas Piccadilly commandos ready and waiting to do business. Ladies of the night, dolled up to the nines, raking in the money, and having to give most of it to the Messina family."
He shook his head.
"You were right to be worried, Miss White, and good for you to be prepared to look after yourself, because no woman or girl was safe."
"Didn't DCI Warren say you could handle a gun? Where did you learn that?"
asked Charlie. Eleanor laughed.
"Steve Warren was having you on a bit there, Charlie. We had a chat one day, and gosh, I can't remember how we got onto the subject, but I told him my father had been an excellent shot. Dad was a hunter, so as soon as I was old enough, I went along with him and he taught me how to shoot straight. Can't say I've as good an eye as my father, God rest his soul. But I had a go, and I know I wasn't half bad. You know what it's like when you're a youngster. You don't want to disappoint your father, and I looked up to him."
She paused, her demeanour now more serious.
"But I do know a bit about the Mackies, and that they're up to something, if that's what you're worried about, which was why DCI Warren asked me to join you for a parley. And because of where I live, I'm in a position to find out more for you to go on. Though with due care, you're the experts, and I defer to your better knowledge. You're the men of the moment, so to speak."
The detectives both shrugged.
"What the boss says goes. We trust him," said Charlie.
There was a lull in conversation before Charlie spoke again.
"The first people to be liberated by the British during the war have been our biggest problem, plus the fact that they're now back among us since demob."
"I'm not sure I understand," said Eleanor.
"It was the blaming criminals, the villains," said Charlie. "The government liberated even the worst of them, giving them the choice of forestry work, joining the army, or having more time tacked onto their sentence if they refused those offers. And of course no one wants to stay inside at His Majesty's pleasure, do they? They get themselves out, given half the chance, and if it's the government doing it, well, there you go. Anyway,
If the Con agreed to do their national service, more than likely the sentence was repealed, or they only had to do a few weeks or months back inside when they were demobilised after the war, especially if they went into the forces and fought on behalf of king and country. So, like I told you before, off they went into the army or the marines, and what did they do there? Let me tell you what they did. They learned more killing skills to add to the ones they already knew. Then they came out ready to do business, and more often than not, with a stash of Lugers, and what have you, left behind by the Germans and Italians when they ran off. And not only that, after the war the Yanks went home, leaving half their weaponry behind, and a lot of it fell into the wrong hands. I bet the boss already told you about that. But the real trouble, Bob glanced again at the mirror to make eye contact with Eleanor, the real trouble is in their minds. He took one hand off the steering wheel to tap the side of his head. All that business of killing, they miss it. It's the adrenaline, isn't it? It's sort of, what do they call it? Addictive. Yes, addictive it was. They couldn't settle in to becoming reformed men going out to a proper job every day. Not when being on the wrong side of the law gives them the promise of easy money and that rush-headed feeling all over again. Eleanor nodded as she took the pin from her hair and repositioned it again. Yes, I understand. DCI Warren has mentioned the same thing.
Yeah, said Bob. He had a chat with some sort of ologist bloke, told us all about it.
He laughed. Trouble is, he's a bit like that himself, rush-headed, running off and sorting out. Reckon knowing how to protect yourself, how to go on the attack with all that Chinese whacking around does the same sort of thing.
Charlie's interjection came with a swift glance sideways at his partner before he turned to Eleanor.
Feels pretty nice knowing you can take care of yourself. Gives you confidence.
Eleanor smiled, though she was curious about what Bob might have divulged had he continued.
I'm not so sure I could have done much to help myself if I came across a gang, Charlie.
She half frowned as she faced Charlie Kettle.
But I would imagine it's not just the boss, but you experience that sort of feeling too, because you were both in the army, and at least if you get rush-headed now, you're on the right side of the law.
She looked out of the window.
Are we nearly there yet?
Detective Sergeant Bob Mills parked the Humber on Addenmore Road, a short distance from a row of idling buses. Hopeful punters were alighting and either running or walking at speed toward the entrance to the stadium.
See that?
Charlie pointed to the buses and the people lining up to enter.
That there is money made from people doing their best to spend whatever they've got handy because they think they're on to a winner, or two or three.
They go in there planning all the wonderful things they're going to do when they come out, clutching a few more guineas than they went in with.
Here, Miss White, said Bob Mills. Would you mind putting your arm through mine when we get out of the motor and walk down the street? There are times we might as well have signs above our heads letting everyone know who we are and why we're here.
Not at all. I'm happy to be part of your disguise. Eleanor looked around at her surroundings. Bit dismal here, isn't it?
See right over there, said Charlie. Last year the express train from London to Ramsgate came off the rails and five carriages tumbled right down onto where all their motors are parked. Only one person died. A miracle was that, only one person killed.
Eleanor looked back at the railway. The stadium had been built on Southern Railway land, so it was between two railway bridges. It seemed a dark, miserable place.
Come on, we'd better get a move on.
Bob held out his elbow toward Eleanor as they stepped out of the Humber, and she slipped her arm through his. As they walked, Eleanor noticed a few uniformed policemen along the way, and that Charlie nodded to each one. It was not an obvious movement of the head, but she was aware of it all the same. Other men lingered near the entrance, either alone or with a companion, while another was pointing out something on a folded newspaper or laughing and sharing a joke. The almost imperceptible acknowledgements as they passed might have been invisible to most, but Eleanor knew these were plainclothes policemen. Already in position. With tickets purchased, the trio took their seats, well chosen, close to both an aisle and exits, with views across the stadium. Eleanor waited until a few minutes after they were seated before speaking.
So, gentlemen, you have both uniformed and plainclothes policemen outside, and I can see them inside the stadium too.
I imagine people are used to seeing a few uniforms present, so nothing amiss there. But the plainclothes men, what's going on?
Charlie and Bob exchanged glances.
Doping, for a start, Miss White, whispered Charlie.
Or deliberate overfeeding so the dog can't run, with the risk of a ruptured stomach into the bargain. And one of our ways of catching the men in the act is to catch the dog in the act, so to speak, the four-legged innocent bystander who isn't actually standing anywhere.
Is there that much money in it? Asked Eleanor.
Is the Pope Catholic? Said Bob,
running an arm along the back of the seat, still playing the part of affectionate husband or lover. Charlie kept his voice low.
Here's how it goes. You've got your favourite to win, or a dog with promise and good odds, and those dogs attract the bets. Everyone loves the top dogs, and only a few punters ever pick the right outsider. Every year, hundreds of thousands of pounds, and I mean hundreds of thousands, are placed in bets at the dogs, and most of that stays in the coffers of whoever's pulling the strings.
It's a cruel sport, isn't it?
You think this is cruel? You wait until you get to the horses, said Bob.
But you're right, Miss White, said Charlie. A racing greyhound isn't good for much afterward. Don't get me wrong, they're lovely animals, but once they're taught to chase, it's not as if they can suddenly become the dog that little Timmy can run about with in the park. They always have to be kept on the leash, and a lot of people can't be bothered with all that.
If they've got a dog, they like to see it run. Most of these races are put down when they stop making money, and the putting down is not done in a nice way.
Then there's the injuries, some of them terrible, said Bob. A couple of months ago, there was this lovely dog, Cloudbreak, she was called. Sweet girl, by all accounts, but what a racer. She was doped and went down in the second lap, but as she fell, her front claws went up under her, pierced her stomach and ripped it open. That dog died a terrible death before the vet got to her. Terrible.
Eleanor put her hand to her mouth, at once remembering the ache she felt as a girl when told that Polo had been taken away to a man named Arthur.
Sorry, Miss White. That was a bit graphic, wasn't it?
That's all right, Bob. I was just thinking of a lovely dog I had when I was a child. He had to be put down too.
Here we go,
said Charlie, pointing to the track. He took a pair of binoculars from his pocket.
Keep an eye on a black dog that'll be moving up on the inside to the front really fast.
After three races focusing on a black dog, then a brown dog and a grey and white dog, Eleanor thought she would see running dogs even if she closed her eyes, and wondered what she had let herself in for when she agreed to accompany the men.
Right, this is one to watch. Sunshine Baby is her name. The brindle with a white chest and four white paws. Smashing little runner she is. Good odds and a favourite for the first time. Lots of money on this one.
Eleanor squinted and leaned forward. In an instant the hare passed, the gates opened and a row of dogs began the chase. Sunshine Baby took the lead within a second. Shouting and screams from the crowd escalated. People stood up and some ripe language accompanied the cacophony. Then the tone changed. Anger, disappointment came with a sudden burst as Sunshine Baby lost the lead, then relinquished second place.
Bob. Yup, I've seen it, Charlie. She's down.
The men stood up and moved into the aisle.
Best you stay here, Miss White, said Bob. Don't worry, we'll find you later, added Charlie.
Eleanor waited 2 seconds, but before she lost sight of the detectives in a sea of waving arms and bad lighting, she stepped into the aisle and began to follow the men. Ahead, she could see them joined by 2 uniformed and 2 plainclothes policemen, and as she looked to the right and left, others were moving. She walked in the same direction. The race ended, and 2 stewards went to the aid of the fallen Sunshine Baby. Eleanor was close enough to see the dog, limp with her mouth open, tongue lolling as white, blood-spotted saliva coated her lips.
It was too much for her, said a trainer to those gathered. One of those who burns out too young. She's done a bit, better let her go.
She watched as Charlie Kettle stepped forward, his identification badge held high.
Police! Not so fast. And no one move, or there will be a lot of trouble. Routine testing by a police vet, added Bob, holding up his own identification. Bent police vet, and probably bent police as well.
A man spoke out from beyond those clustered around the dog.
Your mouth has just got you into a bit of trouble, sir, though I would imagine you're in it anyway.
Charlie nodded to a uniformed constable who moved toward the man.
all right, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it.
The man held up his hands.
I'm just upset, stricken, that's all.
This is your dog? Asked Charlie. The man nodded.
Well, let's all get out of the way so the vet can help her out. See if he can't save her for you, said Charlie. She might even make a good lap dog now, if you'll forgive the pun.
He waved to another man, who might have been taken for a teacher with his tweed jacket, viella shirt, brown corduroy trousers, and his hat askew. Eleanor watched as the man knelt alongside the dog. He lifted her head and flashed a penlight into her wide eyes. With speed, he opened his leather bag, took out a syringe, and passed a test tube to Bob Mills, who held it for him as he inserted the needle into the dog's vein to draw blood. He flushed the blood into the test tube, and Bob pressed home the stopper, placing it back in the veterinarian's bag. With another syringe, the vet drained a clear liquid from a small bottle and injected it into the dog's thigh muscle while looking up at the owner.
A little adrenaline, just enough to help her out. She's been doped and overfed by the race. If you don't want to watch your dog's stomach pumped, you should look away.
Why are you even bothering? Asked the steward, who had been first to reach the dog. Better to let her go. Kinder thing for a vet to do, I would have thought.
The vet, who was taking a long red rubber tube from his leather bag, stared up at the steward. If looks could kill, thought Eleanor.
I'm trying to save this creature because people like you...
He looked around, focusing first on the steward before directing his gaze toward the owner and a man standing alongside him.
And you make me sick.
He continued working as he spoke, holding open the dog's mouth and extending her neck as he pushed the tube into her gullet.
You make me sick because you will kill an animal for the money.
Dr. Adamson, we'll sort this lot out. You look after that poor dog.
Charlie stepped forward and placed his hand on the veterinarian's shoulder.
I'll get the blood sample, run over to the lab, but I want to confirm that you believe the dog has been doped.
No doubt in my mind, said Adamson. Not a bloody shred of it.
Eleanor continued to watch the veterinarian as he pumped half-digested matter from the dog's stomach, taking samples as he worked. Around her, men were led away, two in handcuffs. Another steward, younger than the first, remained.
Son, said Adamson, looking up at the steward, if you know of any other poor creature that might end up in this state tonight, you might as well tell me now so I can do something about it.
The steward reddened and shook his head.
I'm new,
the doctor sighed.
Then I'd advise you to get out of this job while you can. Find yourself something a bit less miserable. This is a bloody nasty business to get into.
Removing the tube from the dog's mouth, Adamson rested his hand on her sleek head and began stroking. The greyhound stared up at him with wide eyes and turned her nose to lick his gentle hand.
I had a feeling you wouldn't stay in your seat, Miss White.
Once again, Detective Sergeant Bob Mills looked at Eleanor's reflection in the rearview mirror as he spoke.
I wasn't in the way. Anyway, you men invited me to come along and see what your work was like at the sharp end, so I thought I'd make sure I followed instructions to the letter. No good my being squeamish, is there?
Eleanor stared back at Bob, who reached forward and started the engine.
What will happen to that dog?
Sunshine Baby?
Bob shook his head and pointed to a motor car parked some 6 yards ahead of them.
That's Dr. Adamson's motor car. Any minute now he'll come out and you'll see exactly what will happen to Sunshine Baby.
If I was going to put money on anything, said Charlie, it's that our trusty vet would be doing exactly what he's doing now.
He pointed toward the stadium exit. Eleanor watched as Adamson emerged, followed by the neophyte steward who was carrying Sunshine Baby wrapped in a blanket. Adamson opened the back door of his motor car and nodded toward the steward who placed the dog on the passenger seat. Adamson closed the door with care, not a slam, as he turned to the steward and spoke to him for a moment, lifting his hand to rest on the young man's shoulder. Then he turned, opened the driver's door, took his seat, and was soon manoeuvring the vehicle onto the road.
There you go. Another dog going home with Dr. Adamson. When she's better, she'll end up in clover because he'll find a good home for her. Probably a woman widowed in the war who needs a bit of company, or a soldier who came back from hell wounded and needs a good friend who won't leave his side. Adamson's got a way of putting injured souls together so they can help each other out.
Pity he's moving away. Mind you, he's wanted to get out of London since he lost his wife.
Eleanor nodded. She was looking ahead, still watching the veterinarian's vehicle.
You're looking wistful, Miss White. Did you want the dog? We could put in a word with Doc Adamson for you.
No, it's not that, Charlie. I think the motor car that pulled out behind Dr. Adamson's might have been the same one. Charlie, Bob, I think the Mackies might be following Dr. Adamson.
The speed with which the two men acted surprised Eleanor. Bob swerved out into traffic while Charlie began shouting orders via the police radio. Calling all cars! Calling all cars!
She held on to the leather grab strap as Bob turned the steering wheel to make a sharp manoeuvre under the railway bridge in pursuit of the Mackies.
Hold on, Miss White, said Bob. We'll sort it out. We look after our own. And Adamson is a bloody good vet. He's not a bent vet either. People like the Mackies can buy a lot of people, but I can tell you right now, none of them have enough money to buy Dick Adamson. He doesn't give a flying you-know-what about money.
That doesn't mean they won't try, though, does it? Said Charlie, taking up the handset again. Calling all calls! Calling all calls!